So, today I am going to be wrapping up a series of sermons that we've embarked on here in the new year called Stuff Christians Do. And there's a lot of stuff that Christians do. And I got to be honest, I think I drew the short straw this month. My teammates, Jason and Randall, they got to address really engaging and non-controversial subjects. Communion, like the Lord's Supper, prayer, worship. These are all like motherhood and apple pie subjects when it comes to Christian spirituality. And today I get to preach on giving. I don't know about you, but whenever talk about money at church comes up, I can just feel the toenails kind of curling a little and the stomach tightening. And it doesn't matter if you've been a part of church your whole life or if this is church experience is new to you, just the awkward feeling of money, the awkward feeling around money, it comes naturally. And I read a while ago, you're going to have to be patient with me. I came down with a cold and I'm really croaky this weekend. But I read about a pastor who decided that he was just going to embrace the awkwardness around money with like reckless abandon. And so one Sunday he walked into the pulpit and he announced to the congregation, "My good people, I have three sermons in my hand today. I have a $1,000 sermon that lasts 5 minutes. I have a $100 sermon that lasts 15 minutes. And then I have a $10 sermon that lasts a full hour. So now we're going to take the offering and we're going to see which one I deliver." You might be comforted to know I only had time to write one sermon, but then again, you might feel differently in 5 minutes. Now, money can be an awkward subject. Sometimes it's because we're just uptight for no reason. Sometimes people in my profession, we can be jerks about money. Kind of like this guy here with the three sermons. Let's just make an agreement today that we'll try to relax a little, and I'll try to be as gentle as possible, and let's get through this together, okay? Despite the awkwardness, the topic of money at church is unavoidable for two reasons, and I'll just quickly share them with you. First off, there's a biblical reason. One of the things Christians do that we talked about is prayer. Well, prayer as a topic in the Bible gets mentioned a lot. It gets mentioned 500 times. Another very like churchy topic, faith. It also gets mentioned 500 times. Anybody want to take a wild guess how many times money is mentioned in the Bible? 1,000. Any other takers? Any other? How much? 500. Well, so back in 1973, there's this businessman and a guy named Howard Dayton. He decided he was going to categorize every reference. He found 2,350 verses on money, and he indexed them. You can find it. It's actually online now, this index. It's really interesting. But when he said that, when he did that study, Howard said that it radically and permanently changed him from a worshiper of money to a servant of Christ. So just based on the sheer volume of the times that money is mentioned, it seems pretty obvious that God cares about money, how we relate to it, and how we use it. There's also a second reason, which kind of ties to the whole reason why it's part of this sermon series. In a nutshell, the history of Christianity reveals that giving is just one of those things that Christians do. Right from the beginning of the church, Christians were known for their radical generosity. There's a famous passage in Acts chapter 2 where Luke comments that all the believers, the whole church, they lived in wonderful harmony, holding everything in common, and they sold whatever they owned and they pooled their resources so that each person's need was met. Generosity is in our spiritual DNA as Christians, and we could take lots of time because there are just so many stories about Christian generosity throughout history. So that's why we're going to talk about it today. But before I go any further, I just want to share two little caveats here. First is I am not a financial expert. There's the one thing that you will not receive today is financial advice. I'm not I'm not going to tell you how to balance your budgets. I'm not going to tell you how much you need to fit charitable contributions into those budgets. That is between you and God, and if you're married, you, God, and your spouse. Second thing is that you need to know about me is I'm a mystic at heart. And I use that word because from what I see in the Bible, all of life is mysteriously intertwined. And that means that the practical and physical part of our existence is inextricably linked to the spiritual and relational part of our life. And this is also true for giving. I acknowledge there is a practical part about giving. Churches like this have bills. There's the light. I like it when I show up at a church. I like it when the lights are on, and when I go into the washroom, I like it when it smells rather nice versus not nice. I like it when I go during the week and there's someone I can talk to. There are practicalities to church life that require giving. And Acts chapter 2, where they pooled their resources and they sold stuff when somebody needed help, that's all really important. At the same time, I believe with all my heart that these practical realities are linked to something deeper and unseen. And so, for a definition today, I'm gonna define giving in this way. I'm gonna say we're talking about giving our money away for the purposes of spiritual growth. Giving is a practical discipline that nurtures our spiritual lives. Now, Jason described spiritual disciplines like a cup that holds a refreshing drink of water a couple of weeks ago. And the practice of giving, like so many other practices like fasting and worship and prayer and solitude, all of those things provide like a structure helps us experience the refreshing, living water of Jesus Christ. And I'm going to take a shot right now. So, to answer the question, why give? Here's what I want to do with us today, okay? Two things. One is, I'm going to share with you why I give. I'm not doing this to set myself up. I've fallen down and gotten up back up so many times in this area of my life. It's not like I have any kind of great example, but my experience lines up with a story in Luke 12 that the things that I've been learning really jive and mesh nicely with that. So if you're a type of person who likes to follow along in the Bible during the sermon, Luke 12 is where you're going to want to put your finger or the scroll to on your device. I hope by sharing why I give that it will help us see how giving works as a spiritual discipline and how it changes our perspective on reality and really how it builds our character. And then we're going to consider the scary question, how much should I give? And I hope that we're going to see that from the broader biblical story that God has some guidance for us on this, and that hopefully that with that guidance, we'll all have a little bit more clarity so that we can have some challenging conversations with God and in our families. So let's start with why I give. Basically, I don't know about you, but I have lots of struggles. And some of those struggles can be addressed by practicing generosity. And here's a story from Jesus' ministry which illustrates what I mean. So it's Luke 12, and I'm going to start at verse 13. Someone from the crowd called out saying, "Teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me." And Jesus replied, "Friend, who made me a judge over you to decide such things as this?" Then he said, "Beware. Don't be greedy for what you don't have. Real life is not measured by how much we own." And then he gave an illustration. A rich man had a fertile farm that produced
fine crops. In fact, his barns were full to overflowing. And so he said, "Ah, I know. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and then I'll have room enough to store everything. And I'll sit back and say to myself, 'My friend, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy. Eat, drink, be merry.'" Life's pretty good for this guy. But God said to him, "You fool, you will die this very night. Then who will get it all? Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth, but not have a rich relationship with God." And then turning to his disciples, Jesus said some really amazing things about our life, our thought life, our worry, and how we relate to stuff. I'll just skim through some of the things he said. "I tell you, don't worry about your everyday life, food, clothes. Look at the ravens. Look at the lilies. If God cares so wonderfully for them, how much more is he going to take care of you? Don't worry about food, what to eat, what to drink. Don't worry whether God will provide it for you. He'll give you all you need from day to day if you make the kingdom of God your primary concern. Sell what you have. Give to those in need. This will store up treasure for you in heaven. And the purses of heaven have no holes in them. Your treasure will be safe. No thief can steal it, and no moth can destroy it. Wherever your treasure is, there your heart and thoughts will also be." So this story shows me that giving addresses a lot of struggles. Let me share three struggles of mine and how they get addressed. Struggle number one: I tend to be self-centered, but giving reminds me that God is central. Jesus is choosing his words very, very carefully here. This man in the parable, he became rich. How? The land produced abundantly. The farmer hit the jackpot, and his retirement plan was to keep all of it to himself and spend his entire retirement on himself. "I will do this. I will do that. Life will be good for me." But it was the land that produced his wealth. And here he is congratulating himself. And God looks down on him and says, "What a fool." This man didn't recognize that God was the actual source of the windfall. The man falls into a trap that we all fall into at some point: self-centeredness. We don't like being around self-centered people, do we? Well, sometimes we are those people. And when I struggle with self-centeredness, giving reminds me that life is not about me. Jesus here, he teaches us to be rich toward God. That basically means understanding that God, maker of the universe, is the ultimate owner of everything. He causes the land to produce a crop. He put the oil in the ground. He planted the beautiful forests of Canada. He even gave us minds that are creative and entrepreneurial so that we can figure out what to do with this stuff to make our lives better. Whatever we have, whatever wealth we generate, it's not ours. It's just entrusted to us by God. And when I forget this, I get self-centered. When I give some of my stuff away, it reminds me that my stuff is actually on loan to me. Struggle number two: I struggle with difficult choices, but giving helps me live with fewer regrets. The reason for this parable is really interesting. Jesus is kind of doing an improv here, because he's actually on this journey, walking around Palestine and teaching away, and then out of the blue, this guy interrupts him and says, "Teacher, make my brother share the family estate with me." And this might sound like a plea for justice, but Jesus sees through this right away, and he identifies the real issue: greed. Jesus tells this parable about a rich man
who ironically dies alone before we can meet the heir. And I can almost picture Jesus making eye contact with this interrupting person as he tells the story, and when he says, "You fool, tonight you die, and your barn full of goods, who's going to get it?" It's as if he's saying to this guy, "Really? Really? You're going to let this stuff get in between you and your brother? Really?" Life is full of hard decisions. And I got to be clear here. Jesus here is not teaching us to never stick up for ourselves. Sometimes we need to draw boundaries, and sometimes that can cause conflict or strain relationships. And we should stick up for ourselves. But that decision to stick up for ourselves is sometimes a really tough decision. Now, this is where the practice of giving comes in. As a practice, giving helps me loosen my grip on my stuff, and it makes it harder for greed to get a foothold in my life. When greed creeps into my life, I've learned that when it taints my decisions, it can lead to some big regrets. Giving, on the other hand, nurtures a different perspective, which asks, at the end of my life, when I look back, will I be filled with regret and wish that I fought harder for my rights, that I fought harder for my stuff? Or will I wish I fought harder for the people I love? Will I wish that I would have worked harder at relationships? It's a tough question. Struggle number three. I struggle with anxiety about the future, but giving builds a secure future. To be honest, I worry about the future. Even when I plan and I save my money, I'm always wondering, you know, is it enough? Is it secure? And yet, with the story of the rich fool echoing in our ears, I want you to hear what Jesus says. He says, "Don't worry about food to eat or clothes to wear. Look at the ravens. Look at the lilies. Sell your stuff, sell your possessions, give to the poor, store up treasures in heaven." I'm not exactly sure what treasures await us there, but what I learn here is that they are more permanent than any of our earthly stuff. And here's the amazing thing, those treasures start to accrue now when we sacrifice our wealth and our comfort. This is a paradox. Giving now helps me worry less about the future. Giving in the moment, maybe I'm the only one who thinks this way, and maybe I'm just a weirdo, but giving in the moment helps me live in the moment. And when I live in the moment, my anxiety about the next moment seems to decrease. I'm reminded that if God looks after birds and flowers, and they don't have the luxury of saving for the future, how much more is he going to look after us as his kids? I don't know about you, but I look after my kids a lot better than I do my garden. By giving, we make a powerful statement. We're saying, I want to use this money to help transform the world into the way God wants it to be. And that leads to treasures in heaven. Whatever those are, they're more secure than any stock, fund, or bond. And it reminds us we can absolutely trust God. So those are the reasons I give. It makes me less self-centered. It leads to fewer regrettable, greed-based decisions. And it reminds me of the secure future I have in Christ. As a spiritual practice, giving changes. It alters my perspective on my material reality. Another way you can put it is giving shapes our character. So that leads to the next question. So exactly how much should I give to build this character, to change this perspective? How much will it take for a new perspective? And that's what leads to the topic of tithing. And so what I've tried to do here is I've tried to dedicate 10% of my word count to the subject of tithing for you guys today. I've had some help here.
a couple of books I found really helpful. One is called God and Money, written by a couple of Harvard Business School guys who did an intensive study on how Christians relate to their money. And another book that actually they found really helpful was something called You Mean I Don't Have to Tithe? And this is a more academic study on, and it kind of deconstructs kind of the modern notions of what tithing is all about. So with that in mind, buckle up, here's a brief history of tithing. First time the Bible mentions tithing is when Abraham went on a raid. He had some family members taken hostage. He went, plundered the hostage takers, and as a voluntary act of gratitude to God, he gave 10% of the plunder to the king of Jerusalem. So we learn there it's voluntary. Moses, a few centuries later, starts to codify tithing, and he builds it into the Torah. And you might be surprised to find out that he actually has three separate tithes that he outlines. First is the Levitical tithe. And this tithe goes to, it comes from Leviticus chapter 27 as well as Numbers 18. And these resources for this tithe really are to go to the tribe of Levi in lieu of the fact that they don't have a plot of land. The tribe of Levi, they're a special tribe amongst all the tribes because they're the worship leaders. They're the ones that take care of the tabernacle and the temple. And they're the ones that are really leading the community in worship. And so a good way to sum up the Levitical tithe is in support of the worship infrastructure. A second tithe is the charity tithe. You'll find this mentioned in Deuteronomy 14. And it's kind of a triannual food drive is what this is. They structured their agricultural schedule around a seven-year cycle where every seventh year was a sabbatical year where the ground lay fallow. And in that cycle, God commanded that on the third and the sixth year, a tithe be collected as kind of a big contribution to the Israelite food bank, I guess you could say. That's the charity tithe. This third tithe that's I found really surprising, you'll find it mentioned in Deuteronomy chapters 12, 14, and 26, is a festival tithe. And it's all surrounding the Feast of Tabernacles, which the best way to sum it up is it's a big kind of camp out in Jerusalem where everybody gets together to commemorate the people's wandering in the wilderness. And God wanted everybody to bring a tithe to contribute to the party. And so when you factor in the timing and the relationship of these tithes to one's annual income, basically the number Moses gives us is 23 1/3% plus other voluntary offerings along the way. That number really got my attention. Especially when you compare that to the latest StatsCan numbers that I found from 2013, is that Canadians, we give roughly between 1 and 4% of our annual income to charity. Now, if you want to be a biblical tither and you want to follow the letter of the law, there's your number. But I have a couple of problems with this number. One is that when you do things proportionally and percentage-wise, it tends to be that the little guy suffers the most. And you think about if a person's monthly income is $1,000 and they give a quarter of it away, they're not left with very much to get through that month, are they? Whereas if the person's income was, say, between $5,000 and $10,000 a month, well, it's not going to hurt near as much, is it? And while systematically it's tougher on the little guy, there's an even deeper problem I have with this, is that when you cap giving at a certain amount, it kind of takes the relationship out of it, doesn't it? It stops being from the heart, and it becomes more of a thing that you check off on your to-do list. And that's why I think that when we get to Jesus and Paul in the New Testament and look at early church history, we don't find any direct teaching commanding Christ's followers to tithe. The best we get are references when Jesus and Paul are giving examples of people. They'll talk about, oh yeah, someone tithes, but that doesn't guarantee that they get it right. And so tithing was never explicitly commanded. That being said, I'm pretty sure that Jesus and the early Jewish Christians, they did practice different forms of tithing. We have an example in the Bible where Jesus actually provided a miracle for Peter to catch a fish with just enough money in that fish to cover the temple tax that they needed to pay. Jesus participated in that system of tithing. But the church was far more radical in its giving practices. They often went above and beyond what tithing would demand. In fact, it's really what got a lot of people's attention in the Roman Empire. Fourth century Emperor Julian actually was complaining about his own government's lack of generosity when he said, "It's disgraceful that these impious Galileans," that's what he called Christians, "they support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us." The church, the early church, were just so caught up with the generosity of Jesus surrendering his life on their behalf that for them to use their stuff to help people, to use their stuff to work together to make the world a better place, that was easy for them. And so it was a radical, and I use the word radical because that by definition, radical means affecting the fundamental nature of something, far-reaching and thorough. So if you really want a number that you can kind of hang your hat on and say, that's the number, well, there it is. That's the mathematical symbol for a radical number. And what Jesus is really kind of leading us into with his example is that just a radical generosity from the heart. Well, history goes on, and then there's the rest of church history, and, well, it's a little more complicated. Like communion, that subject of tithing has just never not been controversial. And since tithing is part of the Old Testament law, it's been debatable whether or not it applies to Christians. And some Christians argue that, yes, it does apply, and others say, no, it doesn't. And I'll just give you two kind of more recent examples from church history. During the church history period in 17th century England, the church and the government actually got together to impose a tithe tax on the people. And you can bet how popular that was with the folk, right? And like I said earlier, you know, when you insist on a certain percentage, it's always the little guy that suffers. And this was just one example of how the church was in cahoots with the government to oppress people that actually needed the most help. And so advocates for church renewal in that period of time, they hated this tax, and they were totally against tithing. Fast forward a couple of centuries and come over the pond to America. This is where the land of the free, where they had the freedom. There was no tithe tax. And what ended up happening is that the very people that were supposed to be leading the people in community, in worship, well, they weren't getting paid. The poorest people in the church were always the ones that were there to lead and guide the people. And so during this period of time, the advocates for church renewal, they were calling for people to tithe. They're saying, listen, we need to look after our leaders and not oppress them by keeping them poor. So that's a brief history of tithing. And just like Jason is going to give the final word on what the actual meaning of communion is, let me give you the final word on tithing. Three lessons. First lesson,
History proves that if there's a way to mess up giving, we'll find that way. But the silver lining is God's always calling us back and helping us learn from our mistakes. Second thing is, I think it's interesting that the tithing laws in the Old Testament, I think they show us what's really important to God in his heart. If you want to know what's really important to someone, what do? You follow the money, right? Well, this is where God was wanting the money to go. He wanted it to go to the worshiping community. He wanted it to care for the poor. And interestingly, fellowshipping and celebrating together as that worshiping community, that's important too. The third lesson is that when Christians get it right, and they get giving right, it's radical and it's wonderful. Early Christians consistently took better care of people. It ticked off Caesar, so much so. And in fact, that was one of the main factors why Christianity spread like wildfire across the Roman Empire, is that people would look around and they saw how much the Christians looked after each other, and they're like, wow, they look out, like, I wanted some of that. I want to get in on that. And that's the radical nature of giving. So Mike, stop beating around the bush. Tell me now, how much, really? I want to experience this change of perspective. How much will it take? Honestly, that's between you and God and your spouse. And if there's one takeaway that I want you to have today, it's not that you should be giving more. Maybe you should be, but that's not the takeaway. If there's one thing I want you to do after today, is I want you to sit down and have this conversation with God. And the way to start this conversation is to consider these words from Jesus that I read to you. Wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will also be. If you want to know what's important to a person, follow the money. Giving makes a powerful statement about what we value. And so a good place to start your conversation with God and your spouse is to take stock of your spending habits and your giving habits and ask these three questions. First off, what do my spending habits say about my priorities? What's most important to me? And how do my spending habits reinforce or contradict what I think or say is really important? Second question, what does my giving say about what I think about God? Giving, I think, is a form of worship. It's a response to the sacrifice that Christ made for us. And like Randall said last week, worship in response to something like that, it's unreserved. Dallas said in his baptismal thing, worship unrelentingly. That was a great word. We got to remember our stuff is on loan to us. When we reserve it for ourselves, what does that say about what we think about God? And thirdly, what does our giving say about what we think about other people? How responsive am I to the needs of my church, my neighbors, the poor? Do I really care about the needs of others? Does my bank account give an accurate picture about how generous I'd like to be? Work those questions in your mind. Talk about them, pray about them. And once they start to kind of clarify in your mind the answers to those questions, then I think you're ready to figure out between you and God what that amount is, what that frequency is. And that's all there is to it. And then I can go on to say, though, is that once you put that into practice, you will experience a change. You will experience a difference. You're going to look at your money differently, and it's going to be challenging. But you are going to see reality in a different light. Let me try to land the plane here with a recent story of generosity that gives me a lot of joy on multiple levels. As you're aware, we've been occupying this shiny new building for about a year and a half. And to get this building, many people, a lot of you here, have given sacrificially to build it, and we are continuing to give sacrificially to continue to pay for it.
And I'll tell you, I'll just remind you, the vision for this renewed building was, among other things, to bless the community of Cochrane, the wider community. And so we try to host all kinds of community functions that make Cochrane a stronger town. One example is the Jingle and Mingle lunch that took place here on Christmas Day. And the vision for this started last summer when a friend of mine, who happens to be of Sikh faith, decided that no one should be alone on Christmas. And I don't know where he got this in his head, but it was like really, like he wanted to do something. And so he approached me about our church providing the space for a simple meal that he wanted to organize. And I thought, well, this is a great idea. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, I already have Christmas plans. You know, it's gonna complicate my Christmas. And so I'll admit, you know, it was tough for me to kind of get behind this thing. But I started talking about it at the office, and I was really humbled by the response of my teammates, especially Daniel, our office manager. He's like, why wouldn't we open our doors to the community at Christmas? And so we opened the door. Does that sound familiar to any of you folks that have been around for a few years? And so on Christmas Day, there were over 70 people gathered here from all different religious backgrounds, including Christians from several churches. And they were all here to celebrate and honor the birth of our Savior, Jesus Christ. I got to admit, it felt a little like heaven. And I hope it becomes an annual tradition. Now, this story gives me joy on two levels. One is I know that this building exists because of the radical giving of many, many people in this church family. And I just thank you for that. But the other thing that gives me so much joy is that we're not treating this building the same way that the fool in Jesus' parable treated his barns. He built bigger barns so that he could just hoard more stuff for himself. We built this bigger barn so that we could give it away. And that's a beautiful thing. And I hope that stays a part of our church culture for decades and decades till Jesus comes again. And at the same time, I hope that it inspires all of us as individuals to be people of generosity. So we're just going to bow in prayer, and I'm gonna invite the worship team to come up and take their place. And I'm just going to lead us in a time of prayer. God, you're speaking to all of us, and we all come here at different levels of experience with generosity. For some of us, maybe it's time that we start. And I pray that you would speak to us and that you'd speak clearly to us and invite us into this life of radical, heartfelt generosity. And maybe there's some of us here that we've been doing it, but we're maybe stuck in a rut, or we're kind of slavishly following a rule that was taught to us when we were young. And I pray that you would lead us to adjust, and that you would open our eyes and our minds to maybe something that you want us to sacrifice. And Lord, there's some of us here that we're just so blessed and we're so happy to be part of your family. And we just want to celebrate, Lord. And so I pray that you would give us joyful hearts, full of gratitude at the love that you've just showered out on us in Jesus. And we thank you. And all of the giving that we do, Lord, it's really to say thank you to you. Amen.